Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Before we get started, if you are enjoying this podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a five-star review. We appreciate all of your support. All right, today we're going to be talking about the two flavors of cannabis in Northern California. Our first guest is sure to give his unique perspective, being located in the heart of the Emerald Triangle. He is a self-described original hippie, and Rolling Stone magazine called him the Swami of Pot. Please welcome co-founder of Swami Select, Mr. Swami Chaitanya.
Thank you for inviting me onto the show. It's lovely to be here.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. And our next guest, I know you didn't need any introduction since you guys have met before, is my esteemed colleague, the Chief Knowledge Officer at New Frontier Data. Please welcome back, Mr. John Cagia.
I'm delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, Swami, from my little research that I did, I found, that you had started off as an East Coast academic and over the years have just transformed into this West Coast cannabis holy man. was there a pivotal moment that changed your path or set you off in this direction of cannabis?
Well, actually, it sort of really goes back to the Summer of Love, 1967. I went to school on the East Coast at Wesley, and then I had a Fulbright Fellowship to Germany, and then I went to the University of Wisconsin to study history. And then in the middle of that, there was this student rebellion against the war in Vietnam. So I got very involved in that. And then I decided I really needed to work on my artistic side. So I stopped doing history and started to do photography and painting and design work. And along with that was the sort of Wisconsin was one of those places, not only for social political action, but also there was a whole sort of cannabis subculture that was happening there. Came out to San Francisco in 1967 in the Summer of Love and was hanging out on Hay Street and so on, and went out to Hippie Hill and smoked a joint and so on. And I did do one more year at Wisconsin, but that was in the art department. Then I moved out to San Francisco in 68. I've just been either on the West Coast or somewhere traveling around the world, South America, India, China, ever since then. So I had a photo studio on Hay Street in 1968-69, and I worked for KQED television for a while. So I'm very much in the visual arts for a long time. And as I said, the cannabis world was an integral part of that, even though it was really underground and subculture. And then my first delving into the business of cannabis is that we in those days were what you called a holding company. I want to emphasize the statute of limitations is over and all that, but we used to get kilos from Mexico delivered, and we would store those. That's why we're called a holding company. We were a warehouse for some local dealers. So we would have 20 or 30 kilos of cannabis in our house at any one time. Our price for that was to roll as many joints as we wanted to. So after a while, the people who really owned the cannabis thought we were smoking too much. So they cut us out of the deal. And then I kind of didn't do much of anything with that, but I was traveling in Asia and so on. So especially in India, up in the mountains and Himalayas, cannabis is such a natural part of everybody's life. It grows on everybody's farm and everybody's smoking chadas or hashish there. The holy men, the babas and so on that I got to be involved with over the years. And that happened because I was working on a film called Sunseed with a fraternity brother of mine from Wesley. And then we went to India and filmed all these holy men gurus in their, so to speak, natural habitat. And also the ones who were working here in the States. And so for me, cannabis has always been involved with the arts. It's always been involved with creative expression. And it's always been involved with a spiritual level of understanding how cannabis really works.
Amazing. I feel like we could have a couple of episodes just on that journey alone. That's incredible. John, any questions for Swami before we move on?
Maybe just one. So why Mendocino? Why did you choose to make Mendocino your home?
Well, I was in India, and I was at a certain point, my teacher told me that I had to go back because my wife, we were separated at that time, but Nikki, who was always my companion, she said she wanted to build a sanctuary, a temple back here in the States. And my teacher told me, he said, and I had to go back and help her. So I was basically sent back here to work on raising a spiritual dimension. And we'd always been sort of attracted to Mendocino. A friend of mine had a cannabis farm up here that I'd known way back in the late 60s in our commune that we had. And it was just one of those places that had a certain magic about it. Somehow for the Emerald Triangle, there's Humboldt and Trinity and Mendocino. And for me, Mendocino is the one that has the magic that appealed to me. And there's a spiritual element in the earth here in Mendocino, especially northern Mendocino, that many people feel. There's a couple of Tibetan ashrams here. There's a couple other Babas, Hindu Babas have been around and so on. So there's something very deep and spiritual about Mendocino as a place. Plus, it's also the source, and it's really, in many ways, the key source of the whole development of a high-grade cannabis. Mendocino always had a smaller cultivation limit. So instead of growing many, many, many plants, we learned how to grow not only the biggest plants, but the best plants. And so that's kind of our cultural heritage of breeders and cultivators and so on.
John, did you make it out there on your last trip out to California?
No, but I'm hoping to make it out there my next trip to California.
Well, you better come up here. That's all I got to say. We have a nice guest room and everything. We have to keep our friendship going, John.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, the Ukiah Daily Journal reports state gives Emerald Triangle $1.5 million to target, quote, worst of the worst pot grows. So this money is intended to help local law enforcement with large unpermitted cannabis growing operations believed to be associated with illegal water diversion, threats to endangered wildlife, or organized crime, as opposed to small legacy farmers. Swami, we mentioned the law enforcement concerns above. What are some of the challenges posed by large unpermitted cannabis growing operations?
Well, one of the problems actually goes to the legalization of cannabis in that it's now just sort of basically a misdemeanor, no matter how big or how bad you are. So that's kind of actually the number of, we don't call it black market anymore. We're trying to get away from that. We're trying to say illicit market, or up here, everybody says traditional market, right? So the traditional market exploded when legalization happened. And so all the people who are now in the traditional market, the illicit market, they have no oversight. As a legal grower in California, the first thing I have to do is get my water use registered from the State Water Resource Department. And then I have to get my wastewater approved of and inspected on that. And then Fish and Wildlife comes out and they look at my pond and my creek and my bridges and my roads and all of that. And I've had to do all sorts of remedial effort, but I've been negotiating with both of them for a while. So we've now spent well over $200,000, not just for permits, but for inspectors, for improvements, for wildlife biologists and geologists and all of that sort of stuff. And we're still not done yet. So all of that is kind of really impacting the small grower who have to be environmentally nice, or whatever you want to call it. We all have to be really environmentally aware because of all the enforcement. All the illegal growers have none of that. And so they don't have the expense of coming into compliance. And with the shortage in funds to the police and sheriff's department, there really isn't any enforcement operation going on. So a lot of these people have come and they started to use bulldozers to terrace off hillsides or cutting down trees. As a legal grower, I can't cut down any tree to put in a cannabis garden. Any kind of oak tree I can't, or any kind of commercial tree. But other people apparently have no qualms about cutting down trees and terracing and bulldozing. And the problem then is that sediment and everything gets into the creeks. They cut down valuable lumber. They're altering the landscape and so on. And so it's just sort of, it's an unequal competition. And since they don't have all those expenses, and to say nothing about taxes, of course, they don't pay any taxes. So all of that gives the illicit market an unfair advantage on how in the marketplace. And so the damage they're doing, there have been stories of people putting a 4-inch pipe into a river up here, Now, we have a drought going on for one thing, but we also have like the Eel River, which goes through Mendo and a part of Trinity and through Humboldt. That's a national scenic and wild river that's protected by the federal government. But they found these giant pipes pulling water out, right? So now, if you're a legal grower, your water usage is actually less than virtually every other agricultural product. So it's the illegal growers who really represent the environmental damage. The legal growers actually, we use less water than tomatoes. Or an outdoor grower has a minimal carbon footprint that's almost not even measurable. And so it's really difficult to survive. And yet we're the ones who are doing it right. And the ones who are having so much financial success are getting away with it.
Going back to the water, how did that change the calculation for you around water and resource allocation as a legal grower?
Well, first of all, like I said, I have to get a permit for my spring, and they only let me use 20% of my spring water year round. I have to let 80% bypass. And I also can't use that for commercial cannabis. Fortunately, I have a pond that's been in since 2006. And they're letting me use that water from the pond for cannabis cultivation. And I have an actual separate permit for that. Both of those cost a whole bunch of money, maybe to combine $30,000 or $40,000. The other thing you have to remember out here legally, the whole cannabis program is basically enforced through what they call nuisance abatement. And it's a whole separate subcategory of law when someone, a neighbor, complains about a nuisance. And then some enforcement agency must respond to that call for a nuisance, and they come out and they check out what's happening. Well, part of the nuisance law is that you don't actually ever, if you're accused, you never know who did the accusing, contrary to regular law, where you can always get to know your accuser. You don't get a day in court because they can come out and summarily abate the nuisance instantly on the premises. And actually charge you for doing that, charge you for the cost of all them coming out there. And you have no appeal. It's done, they've cut down your crop, they're gonna fine you $15,000 or $20,000. And you really actually can't even take it to court because it's a nuisance and it's already done. So that's the problem with the enforcement action, is it depends on someone calling in about a nuisance. And we have friends who live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of illegal growers, and they're actually afraid to call in and report them. Because if someone comes in, they're gonna look at, well, who squealed on us, right? Now, in the old days, there was this omerta thing, this almost like the mafia. No one talked about anything in the old days. Everyone had a vow of silence. And that was the way we protected each other, because we were all under equal risk. And so in those days, there really was this community of everybody facing the same risk. But because it was so illegal, there weren't really very many big grows, right? Everybody was hiding under the bushes and carrying bags of soil on their shoulder as they crawled under the bushes to hide their crop. Now people have got 15, 20 acres. Maybe not that much, so 2 or 3 acres. They've got 10 greenhouses. They've got 30 water tanks and so on. So they're actually very obvious from the air. But because the law now makes it basically a misdemeanor, it's hard to actually shut it down. And the other course, that's why the $1.5 million, the budget for the sheriff's office is also pretty small. Because, listen, Mendocino County is maybe half, a little bit bigger than Rhode Island, maybe half again as big as Rhode Island. But we have 88,000 people. Trinity County is like maybe the size of Rhode Island, they have 13,000 people. So these are huge areas with nobody living there. And as a result, there's no tax base to support the enforcement. So the enforcement has to get funding from outside the state or from the federal government and so on to pay for the helicopters. A helicopter costs $10,000 for every 10 minutes or something like that to fly a helicopter. So a lot of that money has to go just for surveillance and enforcement. And the local sheriff's departments, whether Humboldt, Trinity, or Mendo, they just don't have that money.
You know, it's a really interesting byproduct of the way the cannabis market in California has evolved. It's been in the traditional market very well established for generations. And so there's been a symbiosis in which it has evolved with law enforcement. But with legalization, and then the final kind of concession that this is just not going to be a law enforcement priority, coupled with just the state budget issues that that California has been facing, compounded by issues like COVID. There's just not a lot of money to travel across state-sized counties looking for malactors. And given the number of malactors that there are, it also becomes a bit of a game of whack-a-mole. There's an extraordinary story about Santa Barbara from last week, about the Bay Area, San Francisco last week, where they found a grow with 100,000 plants in it. It's the largest illicit grow that they have found in recent state history. So a reflection of, you know, there's a huge demand, a huge demand here, but because California is such a regulatory aggressive state, the costs for a lot of these legacy growers who are trying to transition to the legal market are really, really prohibitive. There's not a lot of state level support to help the growers make the transitions, make the investments in their properties to do this. And then there's not a lot of law enforcement capital in order to help them to take down particularly the most egregious malactors. And you know, the disruption, it's not just that they are operationally making it more difficult for legal growers because their product is less expensive because they don't have to incur all of these extra costs that come with a regulated market. But to Swami's point, and I think this is one of the really critical issues in California, is the scale of environmental damage that is being done. In a state that is deeply in drought, acutely fire prone, and has a very large spectrum of species that are facing extinction due to the rate of environmental change. Having folks, you know, pouring tons of pesticides and fertilizers into the ground, drawing water out of some of the most sensitive water tables, raising really kind of pristine ecosystems, and doing so with impunity, I think is a truly tragic outcome of the way this transition from unregulated to regulated markets has been going. We do think if there's a ray of light here, it is that the consumer interest in legal regulated markets, particularly as the dispensaries have become more available, the product quality and selection has improved, the prices have started to come down now as folks are starting to hit economies of scale. All of that, I think, is helping draw consumers into the legal markets. But as California continues to serve not just its own in-state demand, but also the immediate production center for the rest of the country, then I think this is likely going to be a challenge that continues for a while to come.
Yeah. Well, the illicit market hasn't shut down by a long shot, and that's what's supplying all the other states in the country that don't have legal cannabis, and some of them that do have legal cannabis, and so on. So it's really a situation. Most of the small-time growers would really like to see the people doing the environmental damage shut down. It gives us a bad reputation. But what you touched on, one of the things, John, is that there are so few retail outlets in for cannabis in California. There's only 1,000 retail licenses that have been issued, and some of those might have 3 or 4 actual retail stores, but still, there's so few places. So with 1,000 places to sell and 7,000 registered growers, it's kind of an equation that just won't work. And what's happened in the South, several in the Central Valley and also down in Santa Barbara County, have come in with either indoor grows or greenhouse grows, and it's really mediocre weed. But what's happened, they've flooded the market with this flower, and therefore the wholesale price we've been hearing is $500 a pound. And there are people up here who are just stopping to grow because it costs me more to grow than $500 a pound, so why even do it? People are talking about, I mean, there's rumors going around, let's take, you know, a couple thousand pounds of cannabis up to Sacramento and burn it on their front lawn and get the whole city stoned, and maybe they'll figure something out, right? Because, you know, how can we survive? And the flooded market has just been, you know, there's no reason to grow anymore unless you can. So our answer to that is to have a brand, which we have, and to make sure that we have the top shelf flower and that we have, you know, a clientele that's willing to pay more for the best, and to know not only is it the best flower, but it's also grown with regenerative means that have no environmental impact. In fact, we're restoring the environment through our methods, and that is going to be, that will tell over time. And even the indoor grows have a huge carbon footprint. So an outdoor grow doesn't have that. So over time, but the question is right now, how are we going to survive this year, and how are farmers going to survive next year if the price flooded with all this inferior product is way below and everybody, but the problem is the retailers haven't really lowered their price. And so the consumer doesn't get the benefit of this. I don't know where it's going to turn out. And it's really a crisis situation. And I'm not sure, you know, we're trying to lobby with the government, and we've been speaking with various, like Nicole Elliott, who's now the head of the new Department of Cannabis Control. And, you know, she's very amenable to try and work with the growers and so on. She's been involved with her a long time. So we're hoping with her, and we're hoping to get the legislature to come in and change some of the onerous rules, and particularly the taxes. You know, the taxes, they're taxes on cultivators. There's no other agricultural product where you tax the cultivator. You tax on their profits. You tax their income tax, right? But you don't tax their growing. The county also has a tax on the space that you grow on. And so if you have 10,000 square feet, you have to pay $5,000 a year tax whether you actually have a harvest or not. That turns out to be double tax on your land. Right. So many of these tax laws are unfair. And why are you taxing medicine? Why are you taxing the farmer? All these things are what some of the things that drive us out of business. And also all the government agents are being so very strict and nitpicking with all the legal growers. Meanwhile, all the little illegal growers have no one checking them. So it's really kind of an untenable situation. And we're just hoping that we can survive it somehow. We're determined.
Well, we like to hear that. I mean, it seems like it's going to be quite the fight, but it seems like you guys are up to the task. Mendo Voice reported, Mendocino County Dispensary launches new contest featuring local farmers. So on the other end of the spectrum, Cure Wellness is launching a contest where customers vote to select their favorite entries from the county's licensed farmers. So entries started being accepted on October 1st, with the competition starting in February of 2022. How effective do you think these efforts to spotlight Mendocino growers have been?
Well, actually, maybe not that successful. Most people always think of the Emerald Triangle as Humboldt. Humboldt always gets first mention and so on. And, you know, we in Mendocino kind of always take a little umbrage at that. And, you know, it's like who started first, who grows better and so on. You know, the Emerald Cup, which has been going since 2003, and Nikki and I have been judges in that since the beginning, that started out as a Mendo Cup, right? Way back in 2003, and we had like 30 entries and a couple hundred people. It was all Mendo. But over time, it, you know, we branched out to Humboldt and Trinity. Now it covers the whole state. So this Cure episode is to try and bring focus back to Mendocino. They're not the only group doing it. There's another group also, which is working, and we're connected with them. And the name is slipping my mind at the moment, but this is a group working towards some sort of collective where the real craft farmers of the mountains can actually promote their product and have a place to sell it. We did have, we were lucky enough to have a farmer's market in the town of Laytonville in the heart of Mendocino County this past summer. And it was a great success. But it was almost a one-off. It took so much time and negotiations to get that one permit. But, you know, there were like 15 farmers there, and everyone sold a bunch of stuff directly to customers. And the people came from all over around the Bay Area and Northern California just because they heard they could meet the grower, and they could also get good deals without all the middleman costs. And so that would be one thing that we could, if we could have farm to table or farmers markets that were legalized here, then it would actually really help a great deal. We're also trying to figure out how can farmers come together in some sort of collective thing, because the problem is when the state set up a law about cannabis collectives, they limited it so much that it would be self-defeating to create a cannabis collective. If we were just or a co-op, if we were a regular agricultural co-op, but they won't let us do that. An agricultural co-op would give us some advantages. So it's very difficult, but we're always trying to promote the quality of Emerald Triangle cannabis, particularly Mendocino cannabis. That's one of the things that we at Swami Select are always talking about. And like I say, there are local groups that are organized, the various local people, and we're constantly in communication with one another. I don't know the people who are doing this cure contest, but it's a good idea. If anything that happens to promote the cannabis, we welcome that. And to say that, you know, we have a reputation, actually it's worldwide. I've been in India and I say, well, I'm up in Laytonville. And they say, Laytonville, I used to live there, right? This is some guy from Germany who used to be there. Mendocino has a worldwide reputation for the best cannabis in the world. And we have to keep trumpeting that. The hardest part is to get our own board of supervisors to realize that. Because they keep wanting to shut us down and open up the county to large growers. And they recently had a county ordinance opening up new areas that have not been grown in before and allowing up to 10% of your land for cannabis growth. And all of a sudden, all the environmentalists, even the hunters and fisher union clubs and all the small growers, we all got together. And we had such a an anti-movement, we had a referendum to go on the ballot. Eventually, the Board of Supervisors had to vote to rescind their own ordinance because it was so contrary to what everyone in the county wanted, except a few very, very big operations that were trying, I don't know, seemed like they were buying, I can't say that, but looked like money was flowing in the wrong direction. And so they got defeated by public opinion. And so we're still working on how to promote Mendocino County. And this is a great opportunity, thanks to New Frontier data, that everybody out there, remember, the best dope in the world comes from Mendocino County. It's worldwide. It's well known. So smoke it up.
John, anything to add to that?
I think Tom just touched on a couple of really important points that are worth stressing. So just one is on the challenge that is being faced by the growers in Northern California to set themselves apart. This didn't matter in the illicit market. You said your cannabis was from Mendo, was from Humboldt, and people kind of understood what that meant in terms of what you were getting. But in the retail market, you know, the where brands are becoming particularly important, there's a lot of very kind of exceptionally talented growers in the northern parts of the state, but who don't have either the resources or the experience in brand building and brand development. So how do you set yourselves apart against the deeply capitalized brands that may be producing lower quality cannabis, but have a ton of capital to invest in brands that look right and feel right and resonate with the consumers? And just to highlight the contrast in how the state cultivation map has evolved, we were looking at some data a couple of days ago of the current set of licenses in the state. So there's actually now been nearly 8,000 cultivation licenses that have been issued. And the two counties that have the highest number of cultivation licenses are Humboldt up north and Santa Barbara, you know, right outside LA. But Santa Barbara now has more cultivation licenses than Humboldt County. So there's been this massive shift in, at least on the legal side, where cannabis is being grown in California. A lot of these operations in Santa Barbara are startup grows. They're being established now. And so many of them don't have the sort of depth of land feel that a grower like Swami would have, having done this for years in Mendocino County. But their agility, their capital resources, their proximity to the local market are giving them some structural advantages that are increasingly challenging for the community in Northern California to compete against. So the combination of the shift in the way this cultivation has been happening, the limited resources and branding, and then what continue to be some really kind of tense local ordinance and governance issues, I think are making this a really challenging environment for growers who want to do it right, but are finding that almost every way they turn, that there are new hurdles being put up in front of them. So there's a lot of debate that is happening about this in California right now. We do think that, you know, as the state's regulatory apparatus starts to see and understand these structural challenges, we expect that there'll be some concessions made to make it possible for particularly the smaller, less capitalized operators to continue to produce high quality cannabis without having to invest as much in terms of getting their businesses regulatory approved, or maybe making some tax-based concessions so they aren't being double and triple taxed based on how and where they operate. But these are really, really challenging issues. And we think it would be an unfortunate outcome if the growers in Northern California, who really gave, you know, gave the state its reputation as epicenter of cannabis cultivation in the country, end up being the ones who struggle the most to survive at the time that California is building what is going to be the world's largest jurisdictional cannabis market.
Well, some of the things you were asking about, how do we promote? And there are a couple of things that are happening now. The state of California has just come out with an organic equivalent certification, and that will helpfully open the market for people to realize that you can get a cannabis cert. Now, you're going to have to pay for that certification, so that's a little bit of a barrier. The other thing that's going on, and this will take some time, is what we call the Appalachians Project, the California Appalachians Project. And I've been very involved in the creating of that. I'm on this nonprofit called Origins Council, and our whole point is to protect the legacy grower from the legacy growing regions of California. It's not just Humboldt and Trinity and Mendo. We've also got Big Sur and Santa Cruz and Sonoma, and also all up into the Sierra foothills. These are all places where people have been growing cannabis for the last 50, 60 years. So the Appalachian Project is to set up particular Appalachian zones, just like for French wine, that will indicate that this is a high quality product, and it will guarantee the consumer that if this says Mendo on it, it really comes from Mendo. And not just that, it comes from Bell Springs Road and it's Swami Select, and this is a guarantee of the highest quality. So the problem with the program is it's still getting underway, and also it will cost money for farmers to get into it because they'll have to do environmental surveys and geologic surveys and so on. But it is some way that you can sort of hopefully at some point protect the small farmer and guarantee for the consumer that that someone isn't just selling you some ditchweed and calling it Mendo, right? So that's one of the ways that we're actively working ourselves to try and promote the small farmer and certain guarantees. We're also looking for definitions of certain words that are protected words, like hand trimmed. What does that mean, right? And hand packed, various things like that, regenerative grown, so that people just can't throw those words around without any particular meaning. So those would be protected terms, somewhat like an appellation. So those are ways that we're trying, but they're sort of down the road, and they will be somewhat costly. But it's just like a trademark, but it's an appellation. And so you do have to protect your appellation. But anyway, that's one of the ways we are promoting our own craft cannabis. And we hope it works.
Well, I feel like if it works for grass-fed, grass-finished beef, it should work for you. Because I know these are starting to become things that people start to actually look for once they're out in the market. Yeah. And you know them to be related to a higher quality product. Any predictions or thoughts for the future for cannabis cultivators in Northern California?
Well, let's see. My crystal ball? I don't know that anybody's been right about any predictions so far in this world where everything is politically defined and there's opposition and so on. The illegal growers here are a big problem, and that's kind of an image problem for our whole industry. But I think the farmers up here are resilient. As John pointed out, we've been doing this for a long, long time. We're sort of the heart and soul of the cannabis movement. And by, you know, holding strict to our standards of organic and even beyond that, regenerative, and also, you know, working with the community and hiring our local people. And you know, see, the thing is, when you have a local farmer, that farmer lives on the land and therefore wants to protect the land. And the local farmer spends their money in the local jurisdiction. So, you know, people have to remember that over the years, almost every carpenter, plumber, electrician would probably get half their income from the cannabis world. And, you know, every Safeway and every clothing store and every Ford dealership, they're all selling at least half of their stuff to cannabis growers. And, you know, we have a huge employment. You know, we probably have about 30,000 people who come in here. Remember, there's 88,000 people in the county. Probably 30,000 people come in the fall just to help us harvest. So there's a huge economic weight to cannabis in terms of jobs, in terms of money spent, and so on. And if you wipe out the heritage legacy cannabis grower, the small-time grower, where is the county going to get that money? Because, you know, the lumber industry faded out, and exactly at that time, the cannabis industry came in and started to supply the county with all kind of money. So, I mean, people complain we don't pay taxes, but when you realize we pay all those consumer taxes, but also what we pay is land tax. And because cannabis came to Mendo, land values went way, 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 way up because of cannabis growing. So that's where the county got its money from taxes, from land values that was created by cannabis. Because in the lumber industry, nobody wanted to live in the back hills on the end of a dirt road, but that's exactly where cannabis growers wanted to live. So the county got all sorts of tax benefit from, you know, farmers developing their land. And also a farmer would, maybe he went out there and lived in a tent for 3 years and eventually makes a little house and puts in a garden and starts to do these things. So they're improving the land. And so there's a whole lot of positive economic features about cannabis that very few people actually know about. And the environmental impact of cannabis, if you really research it, is way, way less than wine growing or dairy farming or anything like that. And we use less water per acre. We make more money per acre than any other agricultural activity. So it's about time the state and everybody else came to our rescue and said, we need these people, right? Because they're doing it right. And they're the ones we want to support and keep alive.
Well, that makes sense to me. You're quite the salesman. John, anything to add?
A few things. I think the point that Swami has made about the economic multiplier effect of high density, small grower communities, it's really hard to overstate. And you've already begun to see this in some parts of Northern California where growers have decided they're no longer possible to compete or the regulations are too stringent to continue to participate and are leaving some of these smaller unincorporated towns. And the town can no longer remain viable. You just don't have enough of a tax base because how integral these growers were to the community. If the regulatory apparatus, the tax structures, and the lack of understanding of what role the cannabis ecosystem has played in the vitality of Northern California isn't understood, then there's a real risk that the long-term effects, the long-term degrading of these communities in Northern California will be both consequential and in some cases potentially irreparable. I think there's going to need to be a lot of consideration of whether the state is willing to allow the dissolution of some of these communities for which cannabis has been the lifeblood for all this time. And then second, you know, I think there's a really important story around educating the consumer around who grows the cannabis that they're consuming and what quality actually means. There's a lot of debate around whether indoor is better than outdoor and whether the greenhouse is the best of both worlds, whether where in the state jurisdictionally grows the best cannabis. But broadly speaking, we still think that, yes, consumers like high quality cannabis. It's hard to say that they have always gotten the best quality cannabis or the information that allows them to make the best informed decisions. So, you know, even as, you know, the brand, there needs to be investment in brand building amongst these growers in Northern California to ensure that they can compete on the shelf against some of these deeply capitalized brands that are in the southern parts of the state. We think there's going to really need to be a compelling parallel effort to explain to the consumer the value proposition of cannabis from Northern California.
Thank you so much for that, John. Before we, we're almost out of time. So before we say goodbye, Swami, we offer our guests the ability to give a shout out to someone in the industry that has inspired them in some way, or you have worked with them, and this is your moment.
Well, there's so many people who came before who have now passed on, like Frenchie Cannoli and Ringo, who helped develop the CBD strains, and Dennis Perrone, all those people I was friends with and so on. But I'd actually like to put a shout out to Tim Blake, who's the one who created the Emerald Cup. And it's been one of the focuses promoting Northern California cannabis for so long, and promoting organic growing and that sort of thing. He's been a friend of ours for a long time. And it's, you know, we did the judging part of the cup, but Tim took care of everything else. And he's been a real stalwart in our community. And, you know, Tim is kind of a crazy, oddball, weird counterculture saint in his own way. A lot of people don't understand him, but he's really got a big heart, and he's done a tremendous lot for the cannabis movement. I'd also like to shout out for someone, Janine Coleman, who has done a heck of a lot of work for protecting the small farmers. She's the executive director of the Origins Council, and she has just been operating, and you know, she speaks daily with the senators and assembly members in the California government and so on. So those are two people who are really doing a heck of a lot of work to further the cause of the small farmer up here in Northern California.
Amazing. Well, I look forward to meeting them someday. Well, thank you so much. We're almost out of time, but thank you, Swami. Thank you, John. This was an awesome conversation. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on Canna Week. Please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. Also, please check out our latest report on the global cannabis industry. You can visit newfrontierdata.com/global-cannabis. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.